This is Paul Burnett interviewing Dr. Alex King for the Mining Project of the Business Series. We're at the Lawrence Convention Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania at the Materials Science and Technology Conference. And it's October 13th, 2014, and this is tape one. Dr. King, welcome.
Thank you.
And I attended your talk this morning. You gave one of the talks of the plenary session of this conference, and it is on a topic that is very current and in some senses urgent. Can you tell us a little bit about what some have called the rare earths crisis?
Yeah, I think crisis is a term that is widely used. We kind of try and avoid a little bit. But what happened in about 2010 is that the world was getting 97% of its rare earths from one place, and that place was China. China announced that it was going to impose restrictions on exports of the rare earths. And there was a degree of concern, not to say panic, about that. So the prices started to rise. Governments started to ask questions of their technical advisors, and concern rose to a high level. What happened in mid-2010 and early 2011 is prices for the rare earths spiked at levels of about 25 times their value prior to the first inklings of a crisis. They subsided back since then, but what came out of all of that was a recognition in a lot of places around the world, including the US government, that we need to be worried about materials for which we have no clear substitutes and for which we only have a single source, no matter where that source may be. So these materials are now called critical materials. And one of the outcomes of all this was the creation of the Critical Materials Institute, which I now have the job of directing.
Right, right. It comes as perhaps a bit of surprise that there was that it was such a surprise. It seems
there's unsurprising surprises are the hardest ones of all to deal with, actually. But yeah.
Were there Department of Defense departments or officials who were in charge of maintaining an understanding of global supplies of critical elements?
Yeah, there is. There's what's called the Defense Logistics Agency, which has the responsibility for making sure that the military in the U.S., or military of the U.S., probably more correctly, has all of whatever it needs. From food to boots to clothing, fuel, but fundamentally the materials to make things from. And every year the Defense Logistical Agency is required to make a report to Congress saying that, or reporting to Congress where they have concerns about supplies of any substance, material, whatever, for the coming 12 months. And usually the Defense Logistical Agency has reported that we have sufficient materials available to us for the next 12 months, and that's all they really report. So it's a very narrow statement. When the Department of Energy started looking into critical materials, they started looking not at what we need for the next 12 months, but what we expect will be the demand for materials 5 years and 15 years out from the present, the present then being 2010, 2011. So they were projecting quite far into the future, and projections that far into the future are not necessarily very reliable. But when they started making projections, it became clear that there are more materials out there for which there are very few suppliers and for which we can project increased demand, and where we have no clear-cut substitutes at the, mm-hmm. at the present time. So they started compiling not so much a list, but actually a diagram, which I showed in the talk this morning, where they plot the sort of essentialness of an element, if you like. You know, how hard would it be to do without this element on the vertical axis, and the question of how hard is it to get this element on the horizontal axis. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that how hard it is to get an element is almost directly related to the number of sources. If there's only one, you consider that to be very much at risk. If there's two sources, it's still pretty highly at risk. If, like iron, for instance, you have sources of iron ore all the way around the world, we don't think that's at high risk. Mm-hmm. So the risk axis is determined almost exclusively by a number of sources. Mm-hmm. The need axis is determined pretty much by how special that material is for its particular purpose. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the rare earths show up as having very high risk for supply disruption, and also high essentiality, if you like that term, for a number of different clean energy technologies. Mm-hmm. And of course, the technologies the military are interested in are a bit different than the ones that the Department of Energy is interested in, although there's a fair amount of overlap too.
I imagine. And I understand that in 2013, the Department of Defense announced a procurement of a stockpile of critical materials, effectively.
Right. Yeah, they named a few different materials that they deemed sufficiently at risk that they wanted to take some actual action to assure the supply for the next 12 months. And among those was dysprosium, one of the rare earth elements that happens also to be on our list. So mm-hmm. there's some convergence of interest right. in that particular material.
Yeah. And perhaps we should clarify, too, because the critical materials as they're defined in under your mandate are not exactly the same as the thing named rare earth element.
Right. So, yeah, and this is sometimes a little confusing. So on almost everybody's list of critical materials today are several of the rare earth elements. And people sort of refer generically to rare earth elements as being critical materials. They're not. Not all of the rare earths are critical materials. Not all of the critical materials are rare earths. But at the top of every list of critical materials that I have seen are several of the rare earths. Mm. So they're kind of the poster children for critical materials.
Right. And I also have read that the term rare earth was coined back in the 19th century to define this group of elements that were at the time thought to be very rare, mm-hmm. but they're in fact not, and for the most part, but the question is extraction and separation. That's the key.
That's right. So I sometimes give a talk where I say they're neither rare nor are they earth. And aside from that, the name's perfect. The better name is actually the lanthanides. I mean, mm-hmm. it's technically accurate and correct. But yeah, the abundance of the rare earths, which is what fraction of all of the atoms in the crust of the earth are this particular element. That's broadly speaking what we mean by abundance. The abundance of the rare earths declines as you go from left to right across the periodic table. Mm-hmm. So from lanthanum and cerium, which are the lightest of the rare earths, there's as many atoms of those as there are of things like nickel or copper. Mm. So not very rare at all. When you get across to the other end of the lanthanide series and you're looking at lutetium, which is among the heavy rare earths, then you're talking about stuff which is actually quite rare. The reason why they were called rare earths, though, is because they were initially very, very hard to separate from each other chemically. They have a peculiar sort of electron structure, which effectively means they have nearly identical atomic radius, at least from one to the next, going across the periodic table. And they have nearly identical electronegativity, which means that the two things that a chemist can use to separate them do not work very well. The size of the atoms are the same, and their affinity for electrons, or their affinity, therefore, for oxygen or hydrogen, is basically the same. And so it was very, very hard to get them separated. And because it was so hard to get them separated, nobody had very much of any of them. So, yeah, they were rare in the sense that nobody had any. Mm-hmm. But they're plentiful, relatively speaking. Mm-hmm. They're not very concentrated anywhere.
Right.
So if you talk about nickel or copper, which have comparable abundance to some of the rare earths, those are available in high concentrations. The rare earths, you don't find such high concentrations anywhere.
And you said that they were initially difficult to separate. Has there been progress in the last 30 or so years in this domain?
Not in the last 30, well, in the last 40 or 50 years, yes. We learned how to separate the rare earths shortly after the Second World War. We learned how to do it on industrial scale after the end of the Second World War. And it's a tedious process. It's not trivial, but it's, you know, it's well understood. We know how to do it. People have been doing it for a long, long time.
Okay.
But it's chemically fairly obnoxious.
Okay. and energy intensive?
Yeah, it can be. So there are several stages, right? When you mine ore, you basically dig rocks out of the ground, and then you crush rocks, and then you separate the powders into the stuff you want and the stuff you don't want. And that's, okay, that's as energy intensive as any other mining operation for a metal. It gets to be energy intensive when you dissolve the ore into acid, which is the first stage. Then you've got a mixed solution of all the rare earths, more or less in oxide or ionic form. That's the point at which we separate rare earths from each other, and that's done by a series of solvent extraction steps, and it can take about 400 steps, 400 stages,
400 stages.
Of solvent extraction. So you're basically mixing organic and inorganic phases together, shaking them up, and hoping that the rare earth you want dissolves preferentially in one over the other. Mm-hmm. It turns out they do under well-controlled circumstances, but it's not very preferential. Mm-hmm. So you get a little bit of enrichment in one phase, a little bit of depletion in the other. So then you do it over again and again and again until you get enough enrichment that you can separate. So that takes a lot of time, a lot of chemicals, a lot of acids, a lot of volatile organic compounds.
Right.
So a lot of opportunities for pollution. Mm-hmm. Then once you've got them separated, you've still got rare earth oxides. And converting oxides into metal is very energy intensive indeed. It's usually done electrolytically, meaning, you know, large amounts of electric current passing through paths of electrolyte and trying to plate out the material you want on one or other electrode.
And so it is a difficult process. It's understood.
Yeah.
It's a difficult process, but it's quite energy intensive and as you said, tedious.
Yeah.
From a mechanical or a chemical engineering perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also an element of toxicity that is perhaps germane to the question of its production in the United States, for example.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
So the rare earths themselves are not considered highly toxic, with the exception of promethium, which doesn't exist in nature anyway. It's radioactive. But the others are not considered toxic. In fact, you can ingest quite large amounts of them and not have to worry about it. Not that I recommend that. But what is toxic is the acids that are used, and they're usually dissolved in sulfuric or hydrochloric acid at fairly high strengths, and you don't want to be around those. And the in the separations plant, you always have large amounts of organic compounds, typically paraffin, frankly, kerosene, which is also not highly toxic, but there's a lot of it. Mm-hmm. It evaporates and you inhale a lot. But the biggest risk, frankly, is fire. These things are done in not very modern facilities, and where there's a lot of kerosene around, people don't modernize the plant because it tends to burn down before you get to that point.
Really?
Yeah.
That's scary. So getting back to this question of the sort of geostrategic imbalance, if you will, mm-hmm. the fact that by the late 2000s, the Chinese had cornered about 97% of the rare earths market.
That's right.
And back in the 1980s, the United States produced a significant proportion of this, something like 60 or 70%.
Yeah, and in fact, the 70s and 80s are referred to in rare earth terms as the Mountain Pass era, because there was a mine at Mountain Pass in California that actually produced the vast majority of the world's supply of rare earths.
Mm-hmm.
As much as was needed in those days. That plant closed down in, I think, 2002
mm-hmm.
and reopened in 2011
mm-hmm.
In the midst of the crisis, although the company, Molycorp, which owns and runs the mine, actually started work on reopening it before the rare earth crisis mm-hmm. was in anybody's viewfinder.
Right.
So they were working on it. They knew that there was a challenge because of all of the resources coming from China. But what happened in 2002, frankly, is the mine became unprofitable.
Mm-hmm.
And it became unprofitable for a number of reasons. There were challenges with meeting the environmental regulations. There was not, as far as I know, any particular regulation where somebody said, no, come, you have to stop mining.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just that the ongoing cost of meeting all the regulations was an added business expense.
Mm-hmm.
And Chinese production was ramping up and Chinese prices were going down. Molycorp at that time could not mine rare earth and sell rare earths for the same prices that the Chinese were mm-hmm. and still make a profit. So
right.
they closed the mine.
Yeah.
And soon after that, China basically owned the rare earth world.
Hmm. Well, and it also seems that Molycorp or its predecessor, there's the Molybdenum Corporation. I don't know if that's exactly the same company.
Yeah, so the name Molycorp has persisted through many owners.
Right.
So at one point it was owned by Unocal, it was owned by Chevron, and then a group of former Corp Chevron employees actually bought out the resource from Chevron and then set about trying to reopen the mine. When it closed, I think it was under Chevron's ownership. And this group of managers bought it from the company and then set it on a track to being reopened.
And they had had some heat, I suppose, because there had been some pipeline or liner ruptures in the 90s, I think.
Yeah, there had been some acid spills, which is not a good thing to happen no matter where you are. It turns out it's in the desert, you know, between Las Vegas and Los Angeles. It's a fairly barren spot, but it's actually a very critical environment for a number of creatures, including the desert tortoise, and, which is endangered. And you know, you don't want to go around spilling acid in the desert tortoise environment. And you know, and one of the things they have done in reopening the mine is to work very, very hard on control of all of the chemicals used there, and in particular recycling all the water that's used in the mine.
Right, and that seems to have, obviously the permitting went through with the EPA and they're fine with what has taken.
So EPA and California Environmental Protection Organization, whatever it's called. But and Molycorp is very careful to explain that that permitting process is tough and fair, and they were happy to go through it.
And so this is going to eventually ramp up to the point where it can produce, I think the statistic was like a quarter of the needed supply.
Yeah.
Is that an ideal?
Well, so it, Project Phoenix, which was the name, you know, of this idea to bring back the mine, comes in two phases. One would get it up to around 19 or 20,000 tons of rare earth oxide per year. And the second phase would add almost as much again. So they'd be producing about 40,000 tons, 36,000 to 40,000 tons per year if both phases come online. They have commissioned phase one. It has been struggling to get up to the 19,000 tons a year, but they announced actually in a press release that I saw just this morning that the final roadblock, they had a bottleneck in one part of the process that was really holding things up, and they have added to their capacity in that part of the plant and claim that they can now hit the 19,000 tons per year rate of production consistently and reliably. They've hit it, you know, once or twice up to now, but they're now confident they can hit it reliably. The question now is the price of rare earths has fallen back down, and with all the glitches out of the system, can they operate the plant at a low enough cost to stay alive?
Is there any conversation with the federal government or the Department of Defense about an infant industry argument about protecting rare earths until such time as the kinks are worked out and they can stand on their own 2 feet in the world market?
Not as far as I'm aware. But there's an awful lot of stuff goes on behind the scenes.
So. Well, they've committed $130 million to purchasing the stockpile. I suppose that's a start, but and I imagine they're probably not going to purchase that from the Chinese.
I think they'll purchase it from wherever they can get it.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And in the case of, and I don't want to, please tell me if I'm getting way beyond your area of expertise. But the claim about there are several sort of proximate causes for the and I'm not going to use the word crisis, but the tension surrounding the rare earth market imbalances in China, And one story is about some geopolitical intrigue, which I'll ask you to explain.
Sure.
And then the other is about the Chinese themselves trying to rein in some of their domestic industries. So could you explain?
There's a lot of things that are said, and there are a lot of things that have happened, and not everything that is said is the whole story or the complete truth. Not everything that's happened is reported completely accurately. So with that as background, when the premier of China was Wen Houli, he is on record as having said that while the Middle East has oil, China has rare earths. And that was taken as a comment to indicate that they would use rare earths to exert political influence the same way that oil is used to exert political influence. The comment went without, you know, very much discussion for a while, but people remembered it when the Senkaku fishing boat incident occurred back in 2010, where the Japanese Navy arrested a Chinese trawler for fishing in disputed territorial waters. This is not an uncommon event in the East China Sea, but on this particular occasion, which was some months after the prices of rare earths had started to rise, and some months after China had announced export restrictions, when the trawler captain was in custody in Japan, China announced that they would withhold any export of rare earths to Japan until such time as the trawler captain was released. Mm-hmm. And this was a serious threat because China is one of the biggest users of rare earths in its manufacturing industry. The rare earths particularly used in making magnets. Magnets are used in making electronics. They're also used in making hybrid cars. And I think that Japan is determined that it will not lose its dominance in the hybrid vehicle area. So this was a very serious threat. It was a clear signal to the world that China was willing to use its ownership of rare earths to get what it wants diplomatically. Well, diplomatically may not be quite the right word in this case. In the background of all that, when China started to restrict exports of rare earths, it was part of a pattern of behavior where they initially restricted the export of rare earth ore in favor of exporting refined metal, so moving up the value chain a little bit. Then from exporting rare earth metal, they wanted to go to exporting finished magnets or finished metal alloys of whatever kind. And from there, you could see the trajectory was, okay, now we've got you only seeing magnets. We want to export not magnets, but finished devices containing magnets or motors or generators or hard disk drives or whatever else. Mm-hmm. And then you could see how it goes on from there, so that China becomes the manufacturer of everything that contains rare earths, not just the provider of rare earths. So there was some concern about losing downstream manufacturing after we lose access to the rare earths. Mm. And then at some point during all this, when the West was complaining about China's export restrictions, China started telling us that the reason for the export restrictions is that we're reducing production so that we can clean up some of the environmental issues with the rare earth mines. And the evidence is that they have been working on that, whether that was the primary cause or how the opinions differ.
Mm. But you do agree, it seems, that part of the story is that the Chinese corporations are essentially integrating vertically. They're going, reaching back into the and they're taking over different parts of the process, from extraction processing all the way to finished goods.
Right. I think taking over is maybe a slightly pejorative term. Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. let's look at what else is happening in China. Mm-hmm. The growth in the world's middle class, mm-hmm. which I alluded to earlier in my talk, is driven right now almost exclusively by China and its massive economic development. Mm-hmm. So the Chinese poverty, poor classes in China, are vanishing as China becomes a more middle-class nation, becomes a manufacturing nation, provided to the rest of the world. What happens then, of course, is that all of those Chinese citizens who have more to their life than just tilling fields or planting rice want more goods, and they want telephones, and they start with electrically assisted bicycles and very quickly move to motor scooters and mopeds, and quickly from there on to cars. So China wants to provide goods for its own people as well as providing for the rest of the world. Mm. It's an interesting question whether they can actually produce enough rare earths or a number of other materials just to meet domestic demand as it booms. So it's not necessarily true that China really wants to eliminate manufacturing in the rest of the world, mm-hmm. but they want to be able to manufacture for their own population. Mm-hmm. And there may not be enough of some materials to meet the needs of China's growth and the rest of the world's continuing demands.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, there can be an element of xenophobia in this, right? There's a lot of China bashing in so many different domains. And that's probably, as you seem to suggest, is part of the story.
Right. And one should be very careful about China bashing. Not everything is exactly as people portray it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
China has its own needs. I mean, and any sovereign nation will strive to meet its own needs. That doesn't necessarily excuse all of the behavior, but you have to understand where China is coming from. Mm-hmm. And the incredible rate of economic growth that's going on there, which frankly could be a benefit to the rest of the world too.
So it's framed less there were and perhaps are some political elements of this, of course, but there is a larger and perhaps anterior question of supply chain management, and a question of who is at the helm when we're thinking of developed nations that are market oriented. There is this question for you mentioned the great anecdote that you mentioned in your plenary sessions, that material scientists for the last 30 years have been trained and have been trained to just deal with them as a question of chemistry,
mm-hmm.
and have not really been taught about where elements come from.
Right.
And so with that in mind, can we talk a little bit about the response to develop the Critical Materials Institute and the mandate to do that? Could you give us a bit of the history of the Ames Laboratory? Because it wasn't a foregone conclusion that it would go to Ames.
That's right.
Can you talk about the Ames Laboratory and your role in it, so we'll get a bit of Dr. King in this story as well.
Okay, sure. So the Ames Lab, the roots of the Ames Lab were laid down as part of the Manhattan Project. there was a chemist working at what was then the Iowa State College in Ames, Iowa, named Frank Spedding. And Spedding was a great separations chemist and was asked by Enrico Fermi to help the Manhattan Project with the separation of uranium. He was specifically, the story goes that he was specifically asked to come to Chicago and work in Fermi's lab doing the separation, and his response, somewhat paraphrased, I think, was, well, I'd be happy to work on separating uranium for you, but I don't want to leave Ames, Iowa, which in his view was the greatest place on Earth to live, and it really is a great place to live. The short story is that a lab was set up on the campus of the Iowa State College in a wooden building, and in that building they separated 2,000 tons of uranium, unenriched uranium metal, which was all of it shipped in used whiskey casks to Fermi's lab in Chicago. So that was the beginning. And at the end of the Second World War, after the success of the Manhattan Project and so on, the then Atomic Energy Commission decided that it had built this great resource through the Manhattan Project and it needed to do something with it. And they came up with this idea of national labs. So the Ames Lab was established as a national lab in 1946 or 47. I'm not sure I have the date right. But the lab was set up then. Frank Spedding was the founding director of the lab. The lab started to work on separating rare earths, which was how that's the very first step in how we got to where we are. So from that day forth, we've really had a center of expertise and excellence in rare earth science. We separated the rare earths. We have the purest rare earths on the planet in one of the labs in one of our buildings. And if anybody wants to do research on rare earths, they either come to the Ames lab to do it or they buy our material to do it in their own lab. So when a crisis emerged around rare earths, there was an assumption that the Ames lab would be part of the response. Mm-hmm.
Were there other contenders? Are there other centers of excellence in the world for research in rare earths?
We are told that there's a lot of research on rare earths going on in China, but we don't see very much of it. Mm. I think it's more engineering level, mining, separations kind of things. But as far as expertise in the rare earths, yeah, there are other places that do research on rare earths or with rare earths, but none that are quite so focused on rare earths themselves as the Ames Lab is. Mm-hmm. The lab, in 2009, 2010, when this was all starting up, had an annual budget of about $30 million, and at least one-third of that was going into research on or with rare earths. So okay. It's unusual to have one-third of an entire national lab focused on anything quite that exclusively.
And the Ames Lab also had a general, broader mandate. A lot of the national labs did,
yeah.
from the 70s on. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right.
Well?
I mean, the Ames Lab, if you ask people at DOE headquarters about the Ames Lab, oh, yeah, materials lab. They invent materials. And that, indeed, is what we do at the Ames Lab. Mm-hmm. We've invented a number of materials. You actually carry at least one of them around in your pocket. We invented the alternative to lead tin solder, so-called lead-free solder that is used in all electronics today.
Right. So. Can you talk a little bit now about how Dr. King fits into this story? Your background, your area of expertise, and the kind of career that you've had that led to leading the lab, the Materials Institute.
Yeah, so I had no background in rare earths when I came to the lab. people traditionally regard me as an electron microscopist, occasional modeler of materials. I've studied interfaces, grain boundaries, all sorts of things, at the kind of level of abstraction that is characterized by the textbooks that I badmouthed in my lecture this morning. So I earned my doctorate at Oxford University. Almost immediately on completion of that, came to the States as a postdoc at MIT. Got a faculty job at Stony Brook State University of New York. 18 years there, including a small stint as an administrator, which turns out to have been kind of important in my career, because that set me up for becoming the head of the Department of Materials Engineering at Purdue University, which happened in 1999. Mm-hmm. I stayed there 8.5 years, so around 2008. I moved to the Ames Lab as the director of the lab. Mm-hmm. And they were in a search for a new director and somehow identified me as a likely candidate. I interviewed, very ill-prepared, but they apparently forgave me for that. And I became the director of the lab. Yeah. And then the rare earth crisis started to show up a couple of years, maybe 2 or 3 years after I had arrived as the director of the lab. And I corralled the team to help write the Ames Lab's response to the crisis. And that response eventually became a proposal which involves not just the Ames Lab, but 3 other national labs, 7 universities, 7 corporate partners. And we wrote the proposal in response to a funding opportunity announcement for a critical materials hub that DOE put out.
Right. And you mentioned in your talk as well that you got... Can you talk about how at first the shortages were first reported, or how the information circulated to you and the lab? How did you first find out about it?
Yeah, I actually first found out about it in the registration lobby of this very meeting about, I think, 4 years ago, in this very conference center. I was waiting for somebody who was supposed to meet me at some particular moment, and there were all these flyers out and on tables in the lobby. I just picked one up randomly and was reading it, and it was some obscure report from some investment house that said, China's restricting rare earth exports, and maybe people should watch this. And I thought, well, heck, I'm the director of the lab that knows more about rare earths than any place else on earth. Maybe we better watch this. And, well, things then started happening at a fairly rapid pace. The first thing that happened was the House Space Science and Technology Committee held a hearing on what was happening with rare earths when the price had only doubled. Mm-hmm. And they asked one of our scientists, Carl Geschneidner, who is very well known in this field, incredibly eminent, probably knows more about rare earths than anybody has ever in the past or ever will in the future. But he was asked to testify, and he dutifully came to Washington, sat in front of the whole committee, and gave a statement and answered questions. And they sent him away. Well, they asked him one question in the meeting, which was, well, Dr. Geschneidner, what do you think we should do about this? And we prepared him for that. Well, you got to tell them that they need a research institute on rare earths, which they do. I mean, we weren't pushing or anything. But then they came back with another question that he wasn't prepared for. And when you're not prepared for a question, they allow you to take it as a question for the record, or QFR, meaning take that one home, think about it, and send us a response within 7 days. And the question for the record was, how much money should we fund this research center at? And so Carl and I discussed that for a bit. We didn't have a particular budget in mind, so we picked a number and said, well, $20 million, that sounds good. And that was the number we submitted to the committee. And a while later, a line in the federal budget appeared to fund a hub, because hubs were this new funding mechanism that Stephen Chu was promoting as Secretary of Energy, and they were around the value of $20 million a year. So there was a line in the federal budget for a critical materials hub, and it actually was 5 years funding for $120 million, so a bit over what we had suggested. Mm-hmm. But in between those, we were pretty certain that there was going to be some kind of a program funded. Mm-hmm. So we started building our team and getting ready for it.
Right, right. And did you get a sense that the reason that it was not simply the doubling in price that led to the House committee? I mean, imagine...
No, I think it was more the concern that maybe today it's rare earths, maybe tomorrow it will be something else. But there are all these things that our military uses, that in fact the military uses almost every element in the periodic table. Mm-hmm. And, the sense in the part of Congress, we do not want to be caught without access to stuff we need. Mm-hmm. And, in open conversation, it's about U.S. manufacturing, and that's a very important part of our security. Having a healthy economy. Mm-hmm. But underlying the thoughts of some, I'm quite certain, is this question of, is our military in good enough shape?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When supplies are cut off, what do you do?
Right. You don't want to go to war with any particular country where you have to get any of your supplies from that country. It's not a good place to be.
It's interesting because I remember Harper's Magazine had, about 20 years ago, had a spread. It was almost like a centerfold. And the centerfold was an image of an M1A1 mm-hmm. Abrams tank. And it had little bubbles around it for all the different materials that are not actually available in the United States and have to be sourced elsewhere. It's all mm-hmm. the electronic components, assemblies, and so on. So there's been a buzz about... strategic, if not minerals, and strategic assemblies or strategic mm-hmm. Components of military parts. Is this, in a sense, the first real response that you've seen, or is this part of a trajectory that has been evolving for a while?
I have to say, we're not directly involved with the military response mm-hmm. in any tangible fashion. And I occasionally meet with and talk with some of the people from the Defense Logistical Agency. Mm-hmm. So they know what we're doing. I know some of what they're doing. That's the nature of the business.
Right.
I also meet and talk with people in the defense labs. Mm-hmm. We are by far the biggest effort on anything to do with the rare earths. Mm-hmm. Or actually critical materials in general. Mm-hmm. A lot of what we do involves international collaboration. Mm-hmm. So there's a trilateral working group on critical materials that involves the US, Japan, and the European Union. And all of the discussions in that group are at the unclassified level. So they're all about commercial manufacturing. They are not about manufacturing for defense needs. Mm-hmm. So, we talk always in the open about commercial things. Mm-hmm. Is there such a thing as dual-use technology? Oh, you bet. So some of the things we do are almost certainly of interest to the military. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that one day there'll be a call about something or other that we've done, and they'll say, you know, is anybody making that? And if we say, yeah, sure, then they'll say, who, where can I buy it? Mm-hmm. And if we say no, there might be other questions.
Right, so. Right. And that's part of the process.
Yeah.
From the press, Carl Geschneidner was framed as a kind of, he sounded the alarm. That's what happened in the press. He sounded the alarm of this crisis. So, in a sense, the Ames Lab got embroiled in part of the media excitement, let's say, around this.
Yeah.
Is that something that you had to manage and be careful of? It sounds like, by the way you answered the questions here, that you're very adept at that.
We have to be quite careful about interactions with the media. I mean, you do not want to be in a position whereby, you know, saying something unguarded or something that could be misinterpreted, you create another crisis or a run on any particular material. You know, I always preface my comments, you know, I don't make predictions about the market. I don't comment on the viability of companies. I don't give tax advice. I don't give medical advice. I'm just a scientist. All I do is worry about the science. But in fact, everything I do is impacted by the geopolitics. Mm-hmm. I try not to overinterpret things I see. There's a very lively industry in commenting on what's going on in the rare earth marketplace. People will sell you very costly subscriptions to information services to tell you things, and you know I have various news alerts, and I see people commenting about this and that, and some of it, well, not quite right, and some of it, well, it's speculation or it's wishful thinking. And you have to sift through it all, but I try not to contribute to any of that. And besides, there's an absolute rule that I don't talk to the press unless DOE knows ahead of time, mm-hmm. and they carefully instruct me on what I may or may not say in any particular circumstance.
Right.
And rightly so.
Right.
I mean, they're there to help make sure that I don't precipitate a new crisis with a slip of the tongue.
Mm-hmm. Especially with as much attention as it must be.
It's very easy to be considered an expert. It's very easy to be misinterpreted as an expert, too.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, perhaps we should change the tape and talk more about the science. And